second week of deer camp, I got a swollen head. I'm lying with the dust balls underneath my bed. I'm ice and grease is blowing in through the tongue and groove. My pants are sticking to the floor and I'm too sick to move. I didn't drink too many, only 30 cans of beer. Must have been that last shot that put me under.
Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of the Packers Podcast. My name is Michael Cohen and I'm here as always with fellow beat reporter Bob McGinn. Our podcast is brought to you by Cannon and Dunphy and we appreciate their support. It is a sunny morning here, a Wednesday morning in Green Bay. It's a beautiful day, Bob. How's it going?
About 48 degrees, Mike.
Yeah.
Right.
Could be worse right now.
And we're thinking about up north, aren't we, Mike? That Michigan deer season.
Well, you are.
The gun deer season in Michigan. It started November 15 yesterday, Mike.
All right, let's not waste any time. What was this musical selection? Because you sent me the idea last night. I played it on YouTube. I said, what in the world is this?
This is a song called The Second Week of Deer Camp. It's by an orchestra called Da Youpers. Okay. I think this song is about 10 years old.
I think orchestra is a little bit of a kind word for these fellows.
And so this is the second day of deer camp in the great state of Michigan. So I thought it'd be appropriate to some of the boys up there in their deer camps and hunting stands and wherever they are out in the woods, stations, that if they listen to our podcast, they'll know we're thinking about them, okay? Now, Mike, do you know what a deer camp is?
No, I have no idea.
I've never been to deer camp myself, but it's where the guys go. It's a 15-day season in the UP in the state of Michigan, Mike, and some will stay the full 2 weeks. Some will stay 1 week. Some will stay 2 days, you know? But it's a time of fellowship, camaraderie, and general hijinks.
Boozing.
What? Turdy beers he's talking about, huh? They have a museum up there, Da Youpers Museum in Ishpeming, Michigan, hard by Marquette on the shores of Lake Superior. I've never been to deer camp, Mike. I've never hunted deer. I've hunted partridge, as we call them growing up, rough grouse. An upland bird. So I've done that, but that's about the extent of it. But we're thinking about you up in the UP today, aren't we, Mike?
If you say so. I don't know if I could survive at deer camp, Bob. They just call it deer hunting season in Connecticut. They don't call it deer camp.
Yeah, gotcha. Yeah. Da Youpers, Mike.
I've never met anybody like them, Bob.
All right, where are we going next, Mike?
Well, you had this this article here trimmed out of our journal Sentinel, and it's a throwback football photo followed by some text underneath, and the sub headline says "Victory, a bright spot in 1959." Which team won this game, Bob?
Well, first of all, Mike, this is in the green sheet, which our editor George Stanley made a great decision and brought this back. People have loved the green sheet. It used to be in the old Milwaukee Journal for generations. And so Chris Foran of our staff is doing a great thing, and he calls it Our Back Pages, and he digs back into history. And here he's talking about Marquette University football. They had a team for, I'm guessing, like 40 years. And he went back into the archives, and the picture here is defeating Holy Cross, 30-12, late in the 1959 season. They closed that season with two victories. They'd had some terrible years. And the coach was Lyle Blackburn. Lyle was a great coach, I believe, at Milwaukee Washington High School. Then he went to Marquette in the early 50s for 4 years. Then he went to the Green Bay Packers from 54 to 57. Got fired when they hired Ray Scooter McLean in 58 before Vince Lombardi came in 59. Then Blackburn went back to Carroll College in 58, returned to Marquette in 59. And after winning that finale in 59, Blackburn said, "The kids wanted this one, and they wailed the tar out of them. Spirit was the main thing. You just can't win without it, and I think we've got it now." But the school officials, the fathers, thought otherwise, and on December 9, 1960, they announced that the Marquette Warriors were dropping football. And it's never come back, Mike.
They were the Warriors back then?
Initially, they were called the Golden Avalanche.
Okay.
But in the later on, they were, and then all during the Al McGuire great years, they were the Warriors.
So when did it change to the Eagles?
20 years ago.
Oh, okay.
It's a guess.
Fairly recent.
Yeah, Golden Eagles?
Golden yeah. Eagles, yeah.
Everybody still likes the Warriors, Mike.
Anything else we got to talk about? So get out of the way here.
I'll save that story for my son Charlie in Milwaukee. He likes living there very much, and I cut out as much history as I can for him, including some of John Gerda's great pieces in the Journal Sentinel.
Anything else we've got here for housekeeping items, or as we like to call them, the more interesting part of this podcast?
On the first leg of our three-legged road trip here, Mike, the flights were great. How about yours?
Yes, despite being ungodly early on Monday morning, everything was fine. I had no issues. I made it home. What time did you get back here?
I was in front of my TV set watching that tape about 10:45 a.m. That was a blessing, a complete blessing.
I was in my apartment at 9:45. Brutal. My flight took off at 5 a.m. I left my hotel at 3:15. Just awful.
Wow.
Awful.
Well, we just came from Nashville, right, Mike?
Yep.
And the defeat was 47-25.
Correct.
What would you like to, I guess a lot of, we need to talk about that defense, don't we?
Well, that's where it started. The first play of the game was a penalty, which I guess technically doesn't count as the first play of the game. And then the second first play of the game was a 75-yard touchdown run by DeMarco Murray. And from there, it was just sort of an avalanche that the Packers couldn't stop. The defense was torched all throughout the first half. Mariota finished with a tremendous passer rating. It was just a comedy of errors, really. What did you make of it, Bob?
Five touchdowns for the Titans, the vaunted Titans in that first half. They averaged 11.0, 32 for 351 in those first two quarters.
Not a bad day's work.
I've seen some general collapses, but that is near the top. It was pretty bad.
So what happened right at the beginning? What happened with the 75-yard run?
I talked to Brian Schwenke, the left guard for the Titans. There was some influencing going on in the backfield, in which the Titan tight end moved to the right, but it was strictly blocked as a strict inside zone to the left. There was not a counterplay. When the tight end, when there was movement to the right, Blake Martinez and Joe Thomas went with it. Okay, they were fooled. That was a problem. Schwenke now is supposed to combination off of Mike Daniels, who's the three technique to the play side. He's supposed to combo off him and then go to the Mike backer, which is 50, Martinez. So what happens, Schwenke just brushes Daniels, and he blocks down double team on whoever was the one technique for the Packers.
I think it was Guyon.
Yeah, okay. Leaving Daniels virtually standing there unblocked. Clinton Dix is supposed to be unblocked. That's Mike Mularkey said that on Monday. But when Taylor Lewan, who's thinking middle linebacker, when Martinez is out of the picture, Lewan adjusts and goes and blocks Clinton Dix, takes care of him. So now it's Daniels and Murray in the hole, right? And you looked at it, Mike. I think Mike Daniels should have taken a step to his right.
Correct.
Rather than going straight for the back.
He came kind of toward the inside a little bit, and it just made it easy for Murray to turn it upfield and then just go. I don't know if Daniels is supposed to come, you know, almost vertically up the field or if he's supposed to angle himself inside. But from what I saw, when he angled inside, that's what created the bigger hole for Murray to run through.
Daniels took the rap. He was quick to say that I let the boys down. He said, it's my play to make. That never should have got out of there. It's on me. Okay, Clinton Dix is mauled by a tackle. Martinez is out of the picture. There's nobody there. The corner on that side, Ladarius Gunter, had been removed on motion across pre-snap.
The reverse. The fake reverse, yep.
So then who you got to chase? You got Rollins from the backside.
Do you think he slowed up?
I just don't think he's fast enough to even get into the picture, and then he just slowed up when it was over. I guess he could have run harder for effect, but I don't really get after him on the play. How about you?
I thought he slowed up. Okay. I thought he could have attempted to shove Murray out of bounds at like the 2-yard line if he really wanted to.
Wow.
I don't think he could have brought him down in the field of play. He would have had to shove him out of bounds. But that's just me.
You thought maybe he could have gotten there.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
Capers was asked about it, and he said not really. He didn't think that Rollins could get there. But, I mean, I watched it 5, 6, 7 times.
Yeah.
And I think he's within an arm's length of him and just doesn't even try. But okay. Maybe I'm mistaken.
Yeah.
I wanted to talk to Rollins after the game, and he declined. Wouldn't let me ask him anything. He said, I don't have anything for you today.
Okay. So, Mike, let's just go to a couple in the next series then, okay? It's 3rd and 14 at their own 26. That's after the Lawan ejection and the guy on penalties. Okay. So it's 3rd and 14. And you look at that, Green Bay's not even lined up. They got 5 or 6 or 7 guys who aren't lined up. There's all kinds of miscommunication, talking, jabbering back and forth.
Gunter's pointing to the inside, trying to figure out who's supposed to be doing what.
A complete mess and an embarrassment. And, I mean, they should be ashamed of themselves for putting that out there. And then just Mariota just throws to a spot out there to number 19. Is that Sharp or Matthews?
Matthews.
Yeah, 21 yards, routine. The next play, 41-yard corner, whatever you want to call it, sideline route to the tight end, Walker, missed tackle. They go down there. Green Bay is just late substituting, waste of timeout. Brutal football. Terrible. Just awful this late in the year to have that kind of sideline miscommunication, not lined up, wasting timeouts, and then 2 plays later you get the option pass for the touchdown. Talk to Delanie Walker on that. Delanie says, I'm coming out of that backfield. It's a tough, tough situation on the corner. He says, I'm going to block the corner. I see he bites. I go behind him. 42, you know, didn't stay as deep as me, and it's just a touchdown.
I was listening to the broadcast when I watched that game back, and the announcers said they saw the Titans run that play in practice on Friday, and they ran it to the left and to the right. And the point by the color commentator, which I think was, what's the fullback, the ex-fullback's name?
Johnson.
Yes. Johnson said that he thinks that the Titans must have been relieved to run that play to the right, because if you run it to the left, you're asking a non-quarterback to throw against his body as he moves the opposite direction. So I think it turned out well for them that it was to the side where, you know, Murray's dominant hand is as a right-handed thrower.
Okay, so that's 14-0. And then the third one, they go 71 yards in 9 plays. Again, drive starts out on that 3rd and 7. The crossing pattern to Walker for 14, couple of missed tackles by 39 and 42.
Goodson smashed into Burnett.
3rd and 3. they throw one to Walker for 19 on a post, kind of zone defense. Just nobody chucking him at the line, just running into open area. And then the touchdown pass to Fasano, 9 yards on, you know, in the past, Mike, that tight end oftentimes would, like, fall down on an attempted block or something. But here he just delayed one little count and was gone and was open by 10 yards. 21-0. Their worst first quarter deficit since 1986, a game I covered, Mike.
It was pretty bad. It was really, really bad.
Let me mention that 86 game, okay? That was the finale at the Meadowlands, and the press box was real low in Giant Stadium at that point. And late in the game, the Packers lost this one 55-24 to conclude a 4-12 season. The Giants were going to the Super Bowl. John Hilton was a special teams coach, and the Giant coach's booth was near our press box, and this thing was low. And Parcells was substituting some people as if to go for a fake field goal or something like that, and then there was a stoppage of play, and Hilton turned towards the Giant coach's booth, stared up there, and took his right hand with his right middle finger and just showed it there for about 5 seconds. And he was just kind of out in the open. And, I mean, I saw it, and I think a lot of people did see it, and it was just incredible. He was fired after that year. At least the Packers didn't get to that point, Mike.
It was bad. You know, the thing that was alarming to me is that there were 3 or 4 guys that just – had horrendous, horrendous games. It wasn't as if, I mean, the mistakes were widespread, but it wasn't like it was one mistake apiece for 12 guys. There were 2 or 3 guys that made mistake after mistake after mistake, and the 2 that come to mind are Kentrell Bryce, who I thought had just an absolutely horrendous game, with the exception of that one breakup that he had deep down the middle, which was a nice play. But he couldn't tackle. He was going to strip the ball when he should have been trying to wrap guys up. He was out of position. He was gambling. And then Mike Daniels had the worst game since I've been on the beat, you know, by far. Worst game in 2 years, easily. Whether it's the penalties, whether it's the 75-yard touchdown, you know, the taunting mistake that he had, which he has screamed at players before. I mean, he got on J.C. Treader's case for doing that exact same thing earlier in the year. I mean, you know.
This year?
Yeah.
I can't remember.
I was talking to our colleague Pete Doherty about it. He thought it was the Jacksonville game. He wrote it in his column.
Oh.
He said that he vividly remembers Treader getting a taunting penalty, and Mike Daniels went after him for it and said, look, we can't do this. And then it's Daniels doing the same thing by shoving, you know, DeMarco Murray into the ground and kind of giving a little bit of a shimmy there as he got up. So just a really bad day for Daniels, really bad day for Bryce. I thought Clinton Dix was exposed on a few occasions. It was just bad. Bad, bad, bad.
So they limp out of Nashville at 4-5. Still, the Vikings lose a fourth consecutive game. They're 5-4, and the Idle Lions are 5-4. So Green Bay, for all its problems in this three-game losing streak, is one game back in this division. And they're ahead of the Lions on the tiebreaker. Vikings just cut their kicker. Vikings lost their second-string left tackle, Jake Long, who wasn't playing very well. He was okay, I guess, but not a very good signing. So they're reeling. The Lions host Jacksonville.
That should be a win for the Lions.
They'll probably lose it. As they say in Michigan, it's the same old Lions. That's been the cliche for 25 years over there, and they very well could lose that game.
So this game that we just saw put the Packers at 4-5, nine games in, just past the midway point. But on the day of this game, you know, you ran a lot of your midseason grades and your midseason column. But let's talk about the grades for a minute. I know that, you know, we'll factor the Titans game into this, although your grades did not because they were done before that game. But sort of how do you see this team, you know, where it stands at this point in the year?
Underachieving, disappointing. They were my pick to represent the NFC in the Super Bowl. I mean, it's not exactly my fault that they're playing so poorly. And, you know, they've had a few injuries.
I mean, I disagree. I think it is your fault. Had you not picked them, this wouldn't be happening.
Thank you, Michael. There's a lot of good players on this team. There's a lot of good coaches, and they're just not doing it, man. Overall, I gave them a D. Coaching a D, personnel moves a D, special teams C-. All these grades would probably be reduced now after this game 9.
So the highest grade that I see here is the rushing defense, which you gave an A. What would you give them after this Titans game if you counted that in your first half grades?
Be down to a B+, probably, huh?
Yeah.
Or a B+, probably.
They can't stop the good teams, it looks like.
Yeah. The pass defense a C, the rushing offense a C, and the pass offense a C-.
Not good.
Not a good card, Mike.
When's the last time they had a D on your ratings? Do you remember?
No.
No? No. You remember what they were last year by any chance? When they were, what, 6-2 or something like that?
I don't look back. I don't know. I got all those things in my files, but I don't check. So, I don't know. That was about that.
A D. Yikes.
I don't know. Then in the column, I kind of said, you know, Thompson's work is generally over, right? The trading deadline's passed. He could sign a couple guys off the street, but he's on to the draft, and, you know, it's just the way it is. So now it's left to McCarthy and Rodgers. And McCarthy certainly didn't do the job in Tennessee, and Rodgers was okay after a terrible start. So, I don't know. On and on it went, and those guys got to do it. They did it in 2010 with a tremendous amount of injuries. They're at the absolute pinnacle of their professions. McCarthy in his fifth year was hitting his stride. He's pushing all the right buttons. He did a great job. One of the great achievement stories in the Super Bowl history, overcoming that many injuries to win as an 8-6 team and as a number 6 seed. And Aaron Rodgers, an unreal second half, an unreal playoff run, and an unreal Super Bowl. In my book, I judge that one of the top six quarterbacking games of all time in Super Bowl history. That was through game 46, I believe. Can they do it again? They didn't do it in game 9. Now they gotta get after it. They gotta get in these playoffs and win the division. That's the way to do it.
And it's interesting too, because you know, a lot of questions that I've gotten or emails that I've gotten are, well, why don't you ask Ted Thompson what's going on, or why don't you ask him why he only had two running backs on the roster? And the reason is because Ted doesn't do interviews during the season. I requested one last week and was declined, and I was told that he'll talk after the season's over like he always does at the combine. And it was interesting because he was sitting right behind us at the game in Nashville. You know, there's two rows in the press box. All the writers were in the first row, and then all the Packers executives were behind us. So it was Thompson, Wolf, Russ Ball, Gutekunst, Highsmith, everybody sitting right behind us. So here's this guy that won't talk, that won't come before the media, and he's sitting 3.5 feet from me, and I can't ask him anything. It's just it's an interesting dynamic here in Green Bay, because it's not like that everywhere. You know, certain GMs will make themselves available, and Ted just has no interest in it. He really doesn't.
So I'll mention this, Mike. You know, the coach was the GM during my early years on the beat. But then when they went to a 50-50 share in 88 with Lindy Infante, Tom Brotts would talk after games. He'd be in the press box. You want him before the game on some roster move. You want him after? Fine. Then Ron Wolf took over for Brotts, ran the show 100%. Wolf would talk, whatever. He spoke after every game. Good and bad. He'd talk. He'd explain what he saw and what he was thinking. Then under Mike Sherman, after Wolf's retirement, Mark Hatley initially, the late Mark Hatley, who passed away about 2 or 3 years into his Green Bay tenure, he would answer questions after games too. He wasn't running the show, Mike Sherman was, but if there was something you needed or if he was asked his viewpoint, he wouldn't necessarily, you know, spill his guts, but he would respond to questions. And then, and Ted would do that, Ted Thompson, after games, I would say his first 3 years, probably 05, 6, and 7, maybe 8, he would, he'd be available in the locker room. You could talk to him. That went on for 3 or 4 years, and then that just kind of went away.
So, you know, one of the things that we talked about, you know, and we hinted at it earlier, is just sort of where this team is, and they're underachieving, they're kind of reeling a little bit, they need to right the ship. And one of the things I just wanted to mention real quick is the leadership aspect. And this was something that our colleague Tom Silverstein and I wrote about last week. It was, you know, a story basically that looked at whether or not there are players that are stepping up as leaders in the locker room. Now, certainly, and you and I have discussed this, Bob, that ultimately the leadership can come from coaches too. It can come from the head coach. It can come from, you know, the position coaches, guys that really set the tone there. But to me, in sports, there has to be at least somebody in the locker room that when the coach is done saying what he needs to say, there needs to be some element of peer-to-peer communication. And I've had a couple guys tell me that when you hear things from a peer, it's different than when you hear it from a coach. And so basically we started asking in response to this outburst by Mike Daniels after the Colts game, whether or not that manner of communication was effective, and secondly, who are the leaders on this team? And Tom and I talked to 9 different guys over the course of the week, and of those 9, only 2 of them said that the screaming, yelling, get-in-your-face style of Mike Daniels works for them. 7 said it does not work. And I want to read just some of the quotes for those of you who might not have seen the story. This comes from a defensive player. It says, quote, "For me, after a loss, yelling is not going to do anything at that point. You know what I mean? That's not the right time to do it. Of course everybody is pissed off that we just lost. If somebody is going to yell, it needs to be the coach. The coach needs to yell. Mike Daniels is going to do what he wants, though. It used to bother me, but now I just close my ears to it." We got another quote here from Morgan Burnett. When asked generally about screaming, not specifically about Mike Daniels, just generally guys who scream and yell. "You don't really need that," Morgan Burnett said. "These are grown men with families. Man, there's just a respect level. You can get your point across without having to get in a guy's face. You can get your point across many different ways. Haha, Clinton Dix said almost the same thing. A lot of people in here have kids and families, he said, so you're not just going to go yell at somebody. You've got to kind of take a different approach with that. I think that's the biggest thing from being in college to being in the league. So these guys are sort of aware of this style and how it doesn't work for them. And yet it seems as if nobody can get through to Daniels, or nobody tries to get through to Daniels to stop it. And we asked them who steps up, who are these vocal leaders? And basically they said nobody. You know, Aaron Rodgers admits that he's not that type of guy. Clay Matthews is that type of guy. Julius Peppers has done it at times, but by and large, it's not in his disposition. The closest thing to a vocal leader they have is TJ Lang, and even he picks his spots. He's not a guy to do it every week to sort of galvanize these guys. He's effective when he does it, but he doesn't want to be doing it all the time. Now, you've covered many, many, many more teams than I have. What do you think is the importance, or how important is it, if it's important at all, to have these vocal leaders in a locker room?
Oh, boy, Mike. I guess it's somewhat important. I'm not real, real big on this. I mean, I believe in talent and size and good coaching, I guess, the coach running the show. That team in 96, in the mid-90s, they had a bunch of tremendous leaders. There's Leroy Butler. There's Reggie White. There's Eugene Robinson, Brett Favre. There was some more on that team. It was an unbelievable team to cover. People weren't afraid. They were willing to take the rap when they screwed up. They said they screwed up, and when others, they persuaded other people to start taking the rap when they screwed up. there was something going on in that locker room every day, and that was a secret to their success, I think. Later on, the team has just been different, you know. When Aaron Rodgers replaced Favre, certainly, he's a different personality. And this team has become very young under Ted Thompson for all those years. And, you know, Wolf's teams weren't that young. Mike Sherman certainly weren't. And now they're young. Now, that doesn't mean youth can't translate into leadership. But right now there is somewhat of a lack of personality in that room.
I agree with you that, you know, the bottom line is talent, coaching, all those types of things. The area where I think leadership comes into play is sometimes before a game, if a guy wants to get up and give a speech, you know, that's certainly part of it. And Haha Clinton Dix did just that prior to the Titans game. But to me, it's kind of like when the game is going wrong, you know, who can sort of pull guys together on the sideline and get things going? Because, you know, McCarthy can come over and talk to guys for a couple seconds, but he's got to keep his eyes on the field. He's got to be on the headset, all those types of things. Even the position coaches, a lot of those guys spend so much time looking at the pictures and trying to get ready for the next series that they don't really have a lot of time to waste, you know, giving some sort of a pep talk. And so that's where I think the player leadership comes into play, is that if you can get somebody that when things are going poorly, you can rally the guys on the sideline, to me that's valuable. And I just don't think they have it right now. And the players that we talked to said, you know, Mike Daniels gets away with these outbursts and these comments where he questions pride and effort because of who he is. They all said he's a tremendous, tremendous football player. He might be the best football player on this team overall. But his leadership style is not working for them, and he gets away with it a lot of the times because of his status as a tremendous player. It'll be interesting to see how this plays out moving forward, to see if guys try and step up or to see if they just kind of go with what they have.
So Mike McCarthy's been asked about the leadership on this team and last year's team, right, several times. And I don't know, Mike, you have a better memory than me. What has he basically said when asked about leadership?
Well, it's hard to say because I think sometimes his answers have differed over the years. You know, I think at times he said that Aaron Rodgers is the leader of this team just because of the position and the pedigree that Rodgers has. But I think when it comes to an emotional leader, he sometimes says that the young guys stepped up. I mean, after this game, that's what he said. He said, we've got some young guys stepping into leadership roles. And to me, that coincides perfectly with what you said about this being a young team. You know, the fact that these young players like Clinton Dix or I'm trying to think who's another young guy that is. Oh, Jaron Elliott said he took over in the special teams meeting. You know, you're talking about guys in their third and fourth years having to take on big roles because there just aren't that many veterans. And it's just it's a different place. I think Mike McCarthy likes it when there's a guy that steps forward in the locker room and can galvanize a little bit. But at the end of the day, you know, I think you're right. There's a responsibility of the players to be ready to play. And there's also a responsibility on the coaches to get those players ready to play. And so I think there's a little bit of both there. It certainly rests with the coaches, and it certainly rests partly with the players. You know, in all the seasons that you've covered, I know the Packers have won a tremendous amount of games in the last 10 or 12 years, but thinking back to earlier when they weren't a good team, when this wasn't a good franchise, do you remember points in time where teams went off a cliff and the locker room just went totally south when the season was teetering? In other words, when they had a chance to maybe try and pull it together, things just went completely the other way. Does that happen?
Well, when I started, Mike, you know, late 70s and then through the 80s, they just were terrible and nobody knew how to win. There were some leaders, but again, it was just diffuse, rudderless. Bad teams, bad everything, just want to get the heck out of town. Have that car started, you know, on December 16 or 18 when that finale. Get the heck out of Dodge, man. And I'll see you for minicamp in April. But now they've been winning for 25 years. And, like, let's just say 2005 when they went 4-12, the one real down, the worst year in that 25-year run. There was a bunch of injuries. That's Ted Thompson's first year. He had got rid of Rivera and Wall. The offensive line collapsed. I can't really remember many particulars about that one. I just can't. Favre was still at quarterback. Yeah, I can't remember. Donald Driver was a leader, certainly, but I can't remember much about that.
Okay. What do you think? You know, everybody has a different personality, and we talked about how Rodgers is not necessarily the type of guy to get up there and give these fiery speeches, even though he gives one on that television commercial that I'm sure we've all seen by now with him and Clay Matthews. But do you think, generally speaking, that when a player or a team has a quarterback like Aaron Rodgers, a true franchise quarterback that is, you know, getting all the endorsements, all the attention, you know, a potential Hall of Fame candidate, when that person is not a natural leader and doesn't have the ability to command the room or it's just not within them, do you think that's damaging to a team when the overall face of a franchise can't be the face of the franchise in the locker room?
I'm not sure, Mike. Can you compare this to other sports?
That's now, a good question.
You've been around, you've covered the NBA.
Yeah.
College basketball.
I think that in sports, across all sports, we sort of put a ton of pressure on these on the best player on any team or these superstars and say that, you know, it's their team. You know, it's LeBron James and the Cleveland Cavaliers. It's Kobe Bryant and the Los Angeles Lakers. It's Tom Brady and the Patriots. You can go on and on down the list. And so when we make it their team, there's sort of this implicit responsibility that we give them that they have to be running this team, you know, that they have to be in charge. And to some extent, I think when you have that level of attention, you do have greater responsibilities. On the other side of things, I think in certain situations, it puts unfair expectations on guys whose personalities might just not be that way. I mean, you can be the best saxophonist in the world, but you might not be the type of guy to lead an orchestra or to lead a band. You know, you can be the best, you could be the best lawyer in the world, but you might not be fit to run a law practice, you know? And so I just think that sometimes it does put unfair expectations on guys. I'm not saying that's the case with Rodgers. I'm not saying it isn't. I just think that to make it somebody's team, it can be a tricky one. And there's no question that the Packers are Aaron Rodgers' team. That's how it's viewed across the country. So it's tough.
So Mike McCarthy, switching to the coaching side of it here, Mike McCarthy on Monday was asked about where he thought the team was and what's going on, and he kind of basically said, Mike, that that he likes adversity, doesn't he? That he likes being in these moments.
Do you believe it? Or is that just what you have to say in this particular time to try and energize, galvanize, invigorate, etc.?
Yeah, and he's very good at that. He's good in these moments. He's good under pressure. He's done it before, you know. He's got teams out of the darkness. And he knows how to play the game, and he knows what to say. And, of course, he'd rather be 8-3 than – that doesn't add up. 7-2, 6-3, yeah. But he made a pretty convincing case, I thought, that day, and he spoke pretty darn well.
I agree. I think he handled that press conference about as well as he could. But that's enough talking about last week and the issues going on with this team right now. We need to take a short break for a word from our sponsor, and then we're going to come back and take a look at Washington.
At Cannon and Dunphy, we're proud of our winning reputation. We're also proud to be the exclusive sponsor of the excellent Journal Sentinel coverage of our great football team. I'm Bill Cannon. To learn more about our winning team, go to our website.
All right, so the Redskins, Mike, 10 months ago, they defeated the Packers 35-18 in an NFC wildcard game at FedEx Field. The teams meet again. The Redskins are 5-3-1. They're 2.5-point favorite. All right, let's look at their offense. They're better on offense than they are in defense. Kirk Cousins is making fewer mistakes. He's playing pretty well. He's 14th in passer rating at about like 95. He's having a good season under Jay Gruden and the coordinator Sean McVay. Big change at running back. They dumped Matt Jones here after 7 games. Jones had fumbled. He's a big back, but he wasn't running like a big back. And they went with Robert Kelly, a free agent rookie from Tulane. Kelly only ran 4.71 coming out. I talked to one scout. They had him on the board, but he didn't even know anything about him. I talked to him about this guy yesterday. Well, Kelly now in 2 games has looked really good. He's looked better than Jones. He's fresh-legged. The guy looks – have you seen him yet, Mike?
I have not. No, I haven't seen him at all.
He's 2.28. He showed a jump cut in this game last week against the Vikings. He's a threat. He's a pretty darn good player.
Bob, I think you could run 4.71.
I couldn't run 8.71. On passing downs, they come in with little Chris Thompson from Florida State, a fourth-year guy. He's not bad. He's got some acceleration. He's okay. All right, that's their running backs. Now, receivers. Let's start with tight end. Jordan Reed is one of the best in the business. He's a matchup nightmare for everybody. Vernon Davis came from Denver via the 49ers. He's off to a really good start. So you got 2 tight ends who can get vertical. Wide receiver, do not know if DeSean Jackson, the ultimate deep threat, will play. He's got a rotator cuff. He missed last week. The guy can get deep. We know that. And when he gets deep, when he's running clear outs deep, that opens up stuff for Pierre Garçon, who really can't run that much anymore, but he's a very tough possession kind of a guy, good after the catch. And Jamison Crowder, Scott McLuhan's 4th-round pick in 2015 out of Duke, 5'8.5". He's got that instant separation that Randall Cobb had 3-4 years ago. Very, very impressive. One of the best slots in the business. Good after the catch. Got enough speed to hurt you deep. He's a real threat.
And we'll probably talk about him again when we get to special teams, I imagine, too.
You got it. Number one punt returner in the business. Ryan Grant, kind of a spindly guy. He's okay. If Jackson doesn't play, he's your third. So they got a lot of weapons, Mike.
They definitely do. It's a team that can score points. And it's going to come down to whether or not that offensive line can hold up. So let's talk about that.
Trent Williams, a top 5 left tackle. Boy, I saw him earlier in the year, Mike. He is the classic dancing bear, just throwing people around. I mean, just mauling them, trashing people. He's out. 4-game suspension for substance abuse. So can you imagine, before this last game, I saw where Jay Gruden said, he kind of caught himself, but he said he wasn't expecting a drop-off. To Ty Nesekhe.
Yeah, I don't know how to say that name either. Nesekhe.
6'8", 335, from Texas State. Played in the CFL, played in the Arena League. He's 31 years old. He started 1 game last year for the Redskins. The guy was up against Everson Griffin, and that's the big reason when I pick games against my son straight up, I took the Vikings because of that matchup. You watch this on tape. Griffin didn't really get anywhere. The guy, not only has he got all this length and height, but he showed some toughness. He's got pretty good feet, and he kind of knows what he's doing. There was no drop-off. I mean, if the Vikings had Ty Secchi, they wouldn't have lost four in a row, I'll tell you. He's a pretty good left tackle. Amazing. All right, the starting center, Corey Lichtensteiger, went out with a calf injury, IR, after three games. So they took Spencer Long, a guard from Nebraska, and moved him to center, a backup guard. Long's been better than Lichtensteiger. He's a really tough guy. I remember a lot of scouts talking about his rugged, ornery behavior and play at Nebraska. He's a good center. Okay, the left guard, Sean Laval, used to start for the Browns. You know, he's on the small side, and he can get banged around. I mean, Mike Daniels can take advantage of that. But he's also feisty. He's a little bit like the guy last week from the Titans. And he's okay. Morgan Moses is playing on a bad ankle. He's the right tackle. Massive length and height, 6'6" and a half or something, from Virginia. Kind of an underachiever, you know, but he's playing tougher than he has in the past, or he did in college. And if he's able to play on this ankle, he's okay.
How often do they run the ball, Bob?
38%, 42% last year, but they've been more productive with it. So they have a run game. The right guard is their best player, Brandon Scherff. McLuhan's first draft pick, he took him number 5 from Iowa in 2015. Scherff was supposed to play right tackle, but he didn't have long enough arms, and it just didn't work out. So immediately, to their credit, they salvaged the thing. They put him at guard, which is important in this day and age against all these fast 3-techs. The guy's been unreal. He's already one of the probably top 10 guards, if not top 5. He's having a tremendous year. You'll see his speed to the second level. He gets on guys quick. And then when he does, they're eliminated. He's a really good player.
What was Charlie's scouting report on Brandon coming out of school there?
Yeah, he was gone for most of that. I did ask him about that, and he wasn't really sure. He was gone.
Okay.
He was better on Brian Bulaga, stuff
okay.
like that.
Okay.
All right, so that's their offense. It's a good offense. They're 4th in yards. It's not great. Cousins will still make mistakes. He'll still throw you the ball. I mean, he made a horrible throw in the red zone against the Vikings, but he got away with no pick, and they scored. Now on the defense, you got Joe Barry, he's the coordinator. It's kind of a 3-4 base. All right, they're not as good. Let's look at the D-line. Chris Baker's their best. They're all huge. They're kind of like Green Bay's guys. They're all 320, 315 plus, very little rush. Chris Baker, except for Mike Daniels in Green Bay. Okay, Chris Baker, you know, he's a veteran. He's okay. He's their best. Ziggy Hood's been with 4 teams, I believe, now. Former Steeler number 1 pick. Not real good. Ricky Jean-Francois, former 49er and Colt. He's okay, plays hard. They're starting to play Anthony Lanier, a rookie free agent from Alabama A&M, inside on passing downs. He's only played 2 games. He was inactive for the first 7. But at the end of this game here against the Vikings, he was on the field rushing the passer. He's raw, but he's 6'5 with 35 and 1/8 inch arms. He could be a factor. Cullen Jenkins, the old Packer, great. A lot of fond memories for us with Cullen, Mike. He was a tremendous player and a tremendous person. He's still hanging around. And, you know, he played some in passing downs, too, and every now and then you see suddenness.
Played for the Giants, too, right?
Yes, he did, yeah. He's a... I'd like to be able to see him. It'd be a night game. Probably won't even get downstairs. All right, now on the – they have 3 pass rushers all about the same. Ryan Kerrigan from Purdue, a 6th-year guy, a leverage power rusher, gives great effort. He's probably their best. But Preston Smith, a 2nd-round pick last year by McLuhan, he's coming on after a slow start. He's a tremendous athlete. You got to like what he does. And then Trent Murphy from Stanford, I think he was a 2nd-round pick in 2014. Trent Murphy doesn't run well, 4.85, but he has power. He has a lot of effort. He's got a pretty good spin move, and sometimes he puts his hand down inside on passing downs. Inside, that's where their problems are. They have problems right down the middle of their defense. Will Compton is a hustler. He's got fast read and react. He's not a great player, and he's on the small side. Mason Foster, a former starter for the Buccaneers from 2011 to 2014, much better against the run than pass. You can exploit him in the flats. The Vikings did that. And Sua Cravens, a rookie from where? Arizona?
UCLA.
Yeah. Cravens plays as a nick.
Or was it USC?
I think UCLA might.
Was I right the first time?
USC.
USC, okay.
Yep. All right, Cravens, too small for linebacker, too slow for safety. So he's one of these hybrid guys, right? Like Buchanan and Mark Barron. Joe Barry likes to blitz Cravens, so they stick him in there in some packages, and he will rush him, and the guy does have pass rush ability. You kind of have to know where he is. That's their front seven. All right, the back end is not as good. Josh Norman came from Carolina, 15 mil average, 50 mil guaranteed. He's going to try to press you. He's going to trash talk you. And he's going to be aggressive. He's a very good player.
Do they tend to match him or keep him on one side of the field?
Not sure.
Okay.
On the other side, you got Bashaud Breeland, third-year starter. He's okay. The nickelback is Kendall Fuller, a rookie who had microfracture, never even ran a 40 for scouts. He's got all the brothers in the league. Fuller tried to match up against Stephon Diggs of the Vikings, and he got killed.
That's the Virginia Tech family, right?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Yep. Fuller can run, but he's not there yet either. So that's their corners. Safeties, both starters out for the year. David Bruton from Denver, game four, whatever his concussion. And in game three, it was, who was that starter? Mike, I got to look that up, okay? D'Angelo Hall, the old cornerback, who's now been a safety for a couple years. D'Angelo blew out his knee in game three. So McLuhan had to scramble, and he moved Will Blackman, the ex-Packer corner, who started at corner against the Packers in that playoff game. He's now starting at free safety. I've seen Will this year show some real plays with range. He's smart. His speed's diminished. And then they had to go to the street, and he signed Dante Whitner, the old Niner and Brown, who was the Browns cut him in February. He was on the street for 7 months. Desperate times call for desperate measures. They sign him, and he rotates with the ex-Bronco Duke Iheanacho. Whitner and Iheanacho will just come down and drill you downhill. But they have matchup problems. You see people going across. I mean, Bradford picked this secondary kind of apart here, and they can't match up, and that's at safety.
I think Whitner might have gotten you once or twice, Bob.
Maybe he did, Mike. Yeah, maybe he did.
I think he won the national title with them.
All right, let's go to special teams. Dustin Hopkins, he's been okay. He's good on kickoffs. The punter, Tress Way, is 31 in net. He's a left footer. Jamison Crowder, as you mentioned, a premier punt returner. And Chris Thompson and Rashad Ross are okay. The special teams of Mr. Coach Kowitka ranked 25th after 9 weeks. That's the Redskins, 5-3-1. They're not a great team, but they're a good team.
Crowder's average is something like 15 yards per return, isn't it?
16, I think.
16, yeah. That's impressive considering last year Micah Hyde averaged 5, I think.
Can the Packers win this game, Mike?
I think they can. Yeah, I mean, I think that there's enough points to be scored on that defense. I think part of it could depend on who's available for the Packers on the offensive line. A full game with Spriggs could be a little bit interesting. You know, this was his first extended action last week, and it was, 17, 18 snaps, something like that. This week, if he has to play a full game, that's going to be tough. But you and I talked about this. I was impressed with how Don Barclay held up in place of TJ Lang. He had the false start, and he gave up one sack or was part of one sack. And other than that, I was impressed. Better than I would have expected.
Yep. The Packers can definitely win this game, Mike. They beat this team by 17 points on the same field 10 months ago. They can certainly win this game. They can win a lot of games left. They just have to win one, and the entire environment around the state and around that locker room will change. They've just got to do it.
Is this Washington team, as it stands right now, injuries included, better than the one the Packers faced in the playoffs?
I think so.
I think so, too.
Yeah, I definitely think so. Even though Trent Williams isn't on the field.
Right.
I mean, Kelly's a better back. They were playing with Pierre Thomas last year.
Oh, I forgot about that.
They got another tight end with Davis. What other change here? I know there's one.
Well, they lost Pot Roast.
Yeah, they did, and that's hurt their run defense.
Terrence Knighton.
They don't have a real classic nose tackle. They can be run on, although I don't know if Green Bay's capable of running on anybody.
True.
Maybe. They need to try it.
My biggest disappointment going into this game is Trent Williams not playing. Why? Because I really, really wanted to see Nick Perry get down on one knee and say, thank you very much for giving me a contract this year, Mr. Williams. I appreciate that. Perry had the game of his life against Trent Williams in the playoffs last year, and without that performance, it was very up in the air whether or not the Packers would have wanted to give him a deal. And the fact that he did has allowed him to have the success he's had this year, and he's probably going to make a decent amount more money now than he would have if that game never happened.
Boy, with a big game against Trent Williams this time, he would have been on the extension or new deal, he would have been a couple million more per year.
No doubt about it. Anything else with the Skins?
Nope.
All right, let's take a look at some of the questions you've got for us. All right, we got a decent amount of questions this week, so we thank you guys for sending those in. The first question comes from Joseph Britt. Joseph wants to know, why should we care about any of this? Football is fine amusement, but no more than that. Our country is in crisis. What say you, Mr. McGinn?
Joseph, football is a diversion, you know? It's a great diversion for everyone. I mean, Mike, you and I know a surgeon in Minneapolis, right?
Yes, we do.
And between operations, he reads our stuff, you know?
And he still got the gloves on from what I hear.
Yeah, and it's just a diversion from his life. And I think everybody, a lot of people, well, to some people, the Packers are their life, right? But for most, it's a diversion that they escape from their workaday humdrum, workaday lives and families and whatever, and read about us and watch these games on TV. As far as the country being in crisis, not yet it isn't. All right, Mike, what do you got for you?
All right, let's see what we've got here. This question comes from Ryan Schildkraut. I apologize if I pronounced that wrong. Enjoyed the article last week about the lack of leadership. Does Ted Thompson gravitate toward players that have his personality? You know, I never really thought of that. I don't think so. You know, I don't necessarily think that personality has a huge bearing on who Ted wants to draft. Obviously, if there's character flaws, that's different. But if a guy is quiet or a guy likes to, you know, be more of a comedian, I don't necessarily think it would matter too much. Do you? Do you think it would matter a whole lot in draft stock whether a guy is more reserved or more outgoing? Assuming there's no character flaws?
I just don't know, Mike.
Okay.
Yep.
I would say no, but, you know, again, it's hard to say. I just think about some of the guys that they've drafted. You know, you look at Blake Martinez and then you look at Quentin Rollins. Those are complete opposite ends of the spectrum in terms of personality. Martinez is really outgoing, loves to chat, loves to talk, and Quentin Rollins is really quiet and reserved, and cornerbacks coach Joe Witt has said they can't get him to say anything in those meeting rooms. So definitely a wide spectrum. Let's see. We've got time for one more here. This comes from Matthew Probst. Matthew wants to know, what alcohol do you guys recommend to get us through the rest of this season? Well, Bob, what do you got up there in that closet? What would you recommend to these fine folks? I know what I'm going to say. What would you say?
Well, up in Deer Camp, they're probably drinking Hartley's Brandy.
Not moonshine?
They love the brandy in the UP, Mike.
Okay.
Hartley's is the UP brand.
Okay.
And for brewski, whatever.
Okay.
How about your choice?
Well, I don't drink. Very, very rarely do I ever drink. But when I, in college, when I was, you know, going out to parties and everything, I used to like gin, you know, gin and tonic, gin and Sprite.
Okay.
Good stuff.
I got another one. Bell's, the beer manufacturer in Kalamazoo, Michigan. They opened a brewery in Escanaba. And so it's called the Upper Hand, as in UP, the Upper Hand up there. And they have a bunch of brews. They brew just for the UP taverns and grocery stores. So I think a lot of that is being imbibed by Packer fans on Sundays and the deer hunters.
Speaking of deer hunters, what do we have here on the way out, Bob?
We're going to hear some more about Beetle and Goofus and Musty and all the boys.
These youpers, man. They're having a blast up there right now, aren't they?
Boy, they are. Good weather, too.
All right. We'll talk to you guys next week.
It's the second week of deer camp. All the guys are here. Drink, make parties, shoot the bull, but never shoot no deer. The only time we leave the camp is when we go for beer. The second week of deer camp is the greatest time of year. Jumbo's crawling through the door. I think he's got frostbite.